fighters today on the podcast. I want to welcome John Warrilow to the show. John is the author of Built to Sell, a book that was written back in around 2011 that's been instrumental in educating me and others around how to build a business that can thrive without you. He then went on to write The Automatic Customer, talking about recurring revenue in your business. And his latest book is called The Art of Selling Your Business, where he takes a lot of concepts and things like that that he's learned from his own podcast, Built to Sell, and put it into a book. And we had a great conversation today about all things selling your business, right? That was a hiccup in the intro. But anyway, we talked about all things selling your business. Even if you don't want to sell your business, you should build your business so that you could sell it, so that you're not a slave to the damn thing. So anyway, head to builttosell.com, check out his stuff. And without further ado, here's John. John, welcome to the fight. How you doing today?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I am doing great. So I did a little bio on you in the intro, but I'm curious, for those that don't know you, who've never heard of you, don't know about your books and things like that, give us the 30,000 foot view of John and how you ended up here.
Sure. I mean, I've been involved in a bunch of businesses that I've started and probably made every mistake there is to make in the book, and tried to write about some of those mistakes in a book called Built to Sell, and followed it up with Automatic Customer in 2015, and now the new book, The Art of Selling. I guess it all started for me when I was in a services business. I had a market research company, and I got to a point in my life where I wanted to sell it. I was kind of done. I wanted to kind of move on. And I went to see a guy who sells companies for a living. His name is Perry Miele in Toronto. And I said, what do you think it's worth, right? And he said, well, it depends on a couple of questions. And at the time, we were a pretty good sized business. We were $5 or $6 million in revenue, good 20-30% profit margins. Like, it was a good business. We had great clients. And we were working with Microsoft and Bank of America. We thought, oh man, someone will want to buy our client list, right? And Perry said, well, maybe. Let me ask you a couple of questions. Who does the research? And I'm like, well, I'm involved in some of the research. And he says, okay, who does the selling? And I said, well, these are big clients. I'm certainly the front guy. I'm doing some of the selling. And he said, okay, let me get this straight. You're a research company. You do the selling. You do the research. There's nothing here I can sell. This company's worthless. And I walked into that room feeling like I was sitting on a gold mine, and I left feeling like I was an idiot. And that sort of kicked off a journey for me. This goes back 20 years ago now, where I tried to figure out, okay, if I don't have a sellable company, then what do I need to do to make it sellable? And that's sort of where my journey started.
Wow. That's pretty cool, man. It's so you scratched your own itch and now you've got what you got now. That's pretty cool. So did you end up selling that company?
I did. Yeah. I went, we morphed it into a subscription-based company, recurring revenue. And ultimately it was acquired by a publicly traded company, New York Stock Exchange listed company. And, it has a nice Cinderella ending to it, but it was, being in that room with Perry when he told me it was worthless was really like a gut punch. And it triggered a whole kind of journey for me.
Well, everything ran through you, right? So it was like, what do they say? And I think I heard this from you at some point through the years was, if you're doing the majority of stuff in the business, then when somebody buys that business, if they buy it and you don't come with it, they just bought themselves a job.
That's right.
And nobody wants to buy themselves a job. So,
No, I mean, certainly not with cash up front. The way a lot of companies sell in that situation where the owner is deeply integral to the business is something called a vendor take back, where, the owner might get 10% of his or her money up front. The rest of it is paid over time, effectively financed by the profits of the company, which sounds like, in theory, okay. The challenge, though, is if the business fails under new leadership and you think about the chances of that happening are pretty high when you think about how well you've, how much you contribute to your company. then the business fails, there's nothing. You basically have very little recourse. And oftentimes guys will walk away with nothing from selling their business under those conditions. So the trick is to get it to sort of to thrive, if you will, without you personally doing all the work.
Yeah. So what's something that you've discovered over the years that typically surprises most owners when they go to sell their business?
Oh man. Well, that it's worth less than they thought oftentimes, that it's not worth much without them is probably the biggie. And again, that just comes down to, if you think about it from the acquirer's perspective, they're looking at this business and saying, okay, like I'm going to buy something. I want it to run and continue to grow. They're on the starting line of their journey, right? And so if you're in the middle, then it's really not worth very much or very, very little in their minds. And so that can be quite shocking. I mean, the antidote to that is to create recurring revenue. Recurring revenue is this like magic secret sauce, which basically enables your company to go and thrive without you personally selling the next job, meeting with the next customer, et cetera. So, you know, if you're a lawn care contractor, if you do lawn care, you know, you can have on-demand services, which is fine. But if you've got recurring contracts with commercial clients, that's infinitely more valuable, right? Because the commercial clients need their maintenance done all year.
Yeah.
And in many cases, those contracts are multi-year. And if you can get multi-year, that's going to be a whole lot more valuable than the kind of one and done. I'll give you an example. Right now, you know, the guys who install alarm systems in a home or an office. So those companies are getting acquired all the time these days. So they have two forms of revenue. They've got the installation revenue, which is sort of the kind of one and done job where you go in, you wire up the sensors, you change out the control panel. That's installation revenue. Then the other form of revenue is recurring or maintenance. Effectively, they call it monitoring the security business, right?
Yeah.
Typical acquirer would spend about 75 cents for every dollar of installation revenue and more than $2 for every dollar of recurring revenue. Hmm. Said another way, your recurring revenue can be worth, in many industries, more than three times more on a dollar per dollar basis than the one and done stuff.
Well, one of my business partners in our contractor sales academy, his name's Steve. He's a, he built and sold North America's largest swimming pool maintenance company 30 years ago. And it was all recurring, right? And he walked away with a ton. And then in 2001, he started a water feature business building backyard koi ponds and stuff like that. And he, well, it's not my numbers to share, but let's just say he just sold his final percentage of the company to his two top employees that have been buying it out over the last few years. And the multiplier was totally based on the recurring revenue of their spring cleanouts, fall maintenance, summer maintenance. I mean, Dan, you know Steve really well. I mean, he absolutely crushed it. And he's always telling these water feature guys that are in our programs, he's like, guys, you're all going for these home run big $60,000 ponds. He says, but if you don't have that money like Netflix showing up every month, you know, your business isn't going to be worth anything because we need you to build the $60,000 pond, you know, or if I buy the company, I got to go out and find a bunch of leads and sales now to do that versus the recurring revenue. And so I think it makes sense for like the landscape industry, like you were sharing in the ponds, window washing, cleaning, things like that, where I have a lot of guys ask me where they struggle is they're like, I want a recurring thing, but I'm a remodeler. You know, I'm a pick another contractor, right? What do you tell that guy that it might not be so obvious what the recurring model could look
like? I mean, niche down is what I tell people like that. So when I say niche or niche down, it really means taking all your customers and trying to bucket them into the reason they buy from you. Because what you might find is that there's a segment of the market that has a recurring need for what it is you sell. May not be everybody, but it may be somebody. I'll give you an example of this. So it comes from an example outside of the contractor space, but I think it serves the point. H. Bloom is in the business of selling flowers, right? And if you think about a flower store, it's got a crappy business model, right? One and done. You go in once a year, you buy your wife Valentine's Day flowers, and you never go back, right? Maybe you're not there for another year. Maybe you buy your mom flowers on Mother's Day. It's a crappy business model. The farmer cuts the flower stem, and the moment they do that, the flower starts to die. Typical flower store in the US throws out more than half of its inventory every single year. Why? Because it's dead in the back of the refrigerator, right? You guess wrong how much. So it's a crappy business model. Plus, you need expensive retail square footage to make it happen. So these two guys come along and say, how do we sell flowers on subscription?
Were they on Shark Tank?
I don't think so.
I saw a flower subscription thing for like $40 or something.
And really?
Yeah. I don't know if it's the same guys, but I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was just wondering.
No. I don't think so. These guys are pretty established. There's been a lot of guys who've come up and sort of tried to rip off their model, but I believe they were the first. They looked at all the different people who buy flowers, right? Again, Mother's Day, Valentine's Day, weddings, graduation, blah, blah, blah. And I think if you try to create a recurring revenue model for everybody who buys flowers, you're in trouble because nobody has the same kind of recurring need. But what they did is identified one little segment. It was hotels. It was like 3% of the people who buy flowers were these high-end hotels.
Wow.
The Ritz and so forth. And what they did is they said, okay, we're going to sell a subscription to high-end hotels. Every 2 weeks, we're going to come and replace the old flowers and put in new flowers. We'll send you a commercial grade invoice because you're a business, not a consumer. Well, they built an incredible business. The average transaction at a flower store is like $50. Yeah. The average H. Bloom subscriber, their lifetime value is more than $4,500.
Wow.
One sale, $4,500 of the value.
Yeah.
And again, so for a contractor, I would be asking yourself, a remodeler, for example, I'd be saying, okay, sure. Everybody's job is different and every consumer is different, but is there a subset of consumers? Maybe it's a GC that you do a lot of work for that you could have some sort of recurring model, or maybe it's a developer who's pumping out the same style of house one over the over, over the over. Maybe there's some sort of maintenance contract you could sell that says, look, I'll remodel your home $50,000. And for $500 a year, I'll come in and keep adjusting anything that needs tightening and loosening. And you might say, well, why on earth would I care about $500 a year? It's something called the Trojan horse effect, which is dirty little secret of the subscription business, is that once you subscribe, it makes you infinitely more likely to buy other stuff from that company. So I'd ask you to think about it, like when you subscribe to Prime, what happened to your behavior as an Amazon consumer?
Went up,
right?
Yep.
Typical Amazon Prime subscriber spends about $3 for every dollar of an average Amazon subscriber, non-Prime member, right? Part of that's the free shipping, but part of it is just once they've got your credit card and that relationship with you, it just makes it easier, right? They've got permission to communicate with you, et cetera. And so that's why I think contractors are well-served, even if it's not the majority of their revenue, to create even a small slice of recurring revenue, because it just makes your consumers that much more likely to buy other stuff from you down the road.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, you said for $500 a year, we'll come out, I don't know, once a quarter and just put eyes on the property, right? And most contractors, and I get this, so I'm not ripping on them, but I'm just saying most go, I'll lose my ass if I do that. If I send a guy out four times a year, right, Dan, we've had this conversation, right? It's going to cost me more to send my guy out there. And I don't like the term like loss leader and all that other shit. I'm into making money now. Right. But I also know, John, to your point that puts me back in their home on their property, shaking their hand four times a year. And I can't tell you, I mean, I've done thousands and thousands of projects through the years, and I can't tell you how many times I would get to somebody's house and I'd be like, yeah, we couldn't find the painter we used last time. Because most guys don't have an email list. Most guys don't stay in touch. Most guys, this and that.
Sure.
So just that one act of just going out there just keeps you in front of people. And there's a stat that one of you guys probably knows way better than me. I know my number's close, but like if somebody's given you money, they're like 80 something percent more likely to do it again.
Sure.
And so I'm so glad you brought that up because it's playing the long game.
Well, and what I'd also say is, like, what are you spending on door knockers, on flyers, on Google AdWords, on all the other stuff you do to market? Sure, it may be a lost leader to send a truck to go see a customer a couple times a year. Maybe you can recover some of that in a small maintenance fee. I mean, HVAC, example. Like, we have an HVAC guy that comes to our house twice a year, changes the furnace filters. I mean, it's, I don't know, what do you charge? Maybe $100 Like, it's not a lot. But I'll tell you, if our furnace goes, first number I'm going to call is that guy's number. Because I have a relationship with him. I'm not going to Google furnace broken. I'm going to call the guy I now know, right? And so I just put it up against, what are you spending on marketing to win a new customer?
Yeah. And if you weaponize the tech to upsell, then you're getting in there.
Weaponize the tech.
You know, if he goes in and it's like it's a filter, air filter, and then you're like, oh, you have a Wi-Fi thermostat that makes your life so much easier. It's like, boom, there's a $300 upsell. You know?
Yeah,
just don't think that way.
So I think it's a really cool opportunity, not only create recurring revenue. There's another element, a driver we haven't talked about that can make your business really quite a bit more valuable. It's one we call monopoly control, and it's inspired by Warren Buffett, the guy who said that he invests in companies with a deep and wide moat, right? Competitive moat. And the thinking is that once you've got a moat, meaning you're the only game in town, you're the one, you know, specialist in that field, you get a bit of pricing authority. It means you can charge more, better margins, allows you to have more money to invest in sales and marketing. And guess what? The moat widens. And so a lot of guys go, yeah, but that doesn't apply to me. I'm in lawn care, or I'm in HVAC, as an example. We all sell the same stuff. I would just challenge you to think, like, how could you do something that makes your HVAC company really, truly different than everybody else? And I'll give you an example. I've got a young son who has a little trouble with asthma. So when there's air, you know, pollutants in the air in our house, like dust or animal or whatever, it can trigger asthma. And so, yeah, sure, I could hire any generic HVAC company to come in and change my furnace filters. Mm-hmm. But what would I pay an HVAC company to come in, not only change the filters, but every, say, 3 months, do an air quality check and give me a report that says, you know, you're about, you know, you're over on these three asthma stimulant. Like, all of, if you could get that endorsed by the American Lung Association, now all of a sudden you've got a recurring revenue stream and a highly differentiated service. Like, that's a recipe for a valuable company.
Yeah, I love that. I wish I could remember the name of the company, and I think it was a plumbing company. This was at least 5-6 years ago. I heard this story. Some guy, they did a bunch of customer research on their ideal client and this and that, and they found that, you know, like most trades, you're dealing with the woman of the home, right? The wife's home, and, you know, whatever. And in most cases, like it, and Dan, probably the same with you as a painter, right? When I had my painting company, 90% of the people we were dealing with was the female of the home, the woman of the home, and just is what it is. And what this plumbing, I'm pretty sure it was a plumbing company, what they figured out was, because of that, the biggest unmet need of these clients was there was just other crap around the house. Like, move a box from the basement upstairs. I need a hand moving the damn piano out so I can vacuum behind it and slide it back. So I think they started adding like 30 minutes of, we'll help you do shit around the house.
Honey-do list.
Right?
Yeah.
Change the smoke detector thing. I've been asking my husband for 3 months to do this and he doesn't do it and blah, blah, blah. And this guy's business like tripled in a year because of that one unique selling proposition there, right? Or whatever you want to call it.
Yep.
So just, they just did shit for people. Like,
yeah.
And they're like, and I remember reading the article, they're like, what's the craziest thing? And one lady's like, one of the texts was like, yeah, she asked me to clean the kitchen and put all the dishes in the dishwasher and start the dishwasher, right? And wipe the counters down and stuff. And he's like, cool. So he took about 20 minutes to do that and anything else. And she's like, no, it's great. Got a great review, moved on, and their business exploded. So let's back up to Dan, you had shared in the beginning that most contractors aren't even thinking about selling their business, right? We'll take us back to there, Dan, of what you were thinking before we jumped on here.
Yeah, I was looking on your site, and it's kind of like the 8 fundamental things to grow a business to sell. And, you know, years ago in one of our other groups is Tom, who brought up Steve, the person he mentioned, selling his business because he was on this track to sell it to his two top guys. And I remember the vast majority of people in the group are like, I have no intention of selling my business. You know, they even tend to be business owners originally. They just break for tradesmen that fell into their own business. But as I read through your list, I'm like, these are all criteria that we're all seeking. This is why we became entrepreneurs, like financially independent, to have freedom of choice, to all these characteristics. So you don't have to, even if this isn't your end goal, and I think you have this on your website, it's like, even if you're never planning on selling your business, these are, this checklist will just build you a solid business and by default, kind of a better life, because you got a business that's going to run by itself. It doesn't require you every minute of the day, which is what we hear our guys running themselves ragged on. So what are your thoughts on that? You know, given just like, you know, guys that this isn't maybe at the moment their forefront of their mind, but you know, how could this mindset get them to their desired goal?
Yeah, I've had the very same experience. Like I'll do, you know, speeches prior to COVID, the pandemic. I you know, do audiences, mm-hmm. and I'll get them to raise their hand. I'll say, look, how many of you guys want to sell your business? And like out of a room of 100, maybe one will, you know, ballsy enough to put their hand up and go, yeah, me. And then I'll say a different question. I'll say, how many would like to know you could sell your business? And like everyone hands in the air, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not that they want to sell. It's just like, yeah, I want to know I'm building an asset that like when I'm ready, this could be worth something. And I think building a valuable company gives you the ultimate poker hand in the game of life. Like, yeah, you could sell it. But again, most people don't want to sell. They just want to know they could. Building a valuable company, the essence of it is that it works without you. And I think for most entrepreneurs, maybe guys like Elon Musk are different, but I think for most entrepreneurs, it's not about wealth creation. It's about freedom. And wealth happens to give you freedom. You can buy freedom. You can shoot it with your money gun if you want. And that's really what people want, is the freedom, I think, as opposed to just looking at more zeros in their bank account. They want the freedom to decide who to work with, what jobs to take, what customers to do business with, et cetera. They want freedom. And I think having a sellable company, one that doesn't necessarily require you to show up, is the ultimate freedom. I think that's the panacea. And that's what we, you know, that's what we talk about, is like, how do you get this thing, not so that you can sell it and retire to the Cayman Islands, it's more like, how do you get it so that it doesn't rely on you, so that you've got freedom? I agree so much with you, Dan, that's the aspiration for so many entrepreneurs.
Fighters, if you're looking for a step-by-step action plan for growing your business and making more money, putting at least $100,000 of personal income in your pocket every year, if you're not at that point yet, you need to be in our 100K program. If you go to thecontractorfight.com/100K-contractor, you can learn more. But I'm telling you guys, the average home improvement contractor is not making enough money. The average home improvement contractor is slinging it every day, busting his ass, with not a whole lot to show for it, except, you know, a stressed out home life, not enough money in the bank account, a bunch of chaos in the business, climbing debt, and a bunch of other shit that ain't so positive. So we're opening up our 100K program again. And guys, this is for people that don't want to fuck around anymore and you really want to make a change, okay? You want to be held accountable. You want a resource of coaches in many disciplines to be able to answer your questions. You want access to checklists, spreadsheets, motivation, blah, 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 to get you a few percentage points better each month so that by the end of 1 year, you are at least at the $100,000 personal income mark. We've had hundreds of contractors go through this, and they're a part of this that are kicking some ass. And so jump on in when you're ready. thecontractorfight.com/100K-contractor. All right, I got a couple rapid fire questions here. It's been my experience working with contractors, and maybe this is just the contractor world, worked with thousands of them over the years, that the number one most difficult role for them to fill is that of the salesperson. And yeah. I'm curious what you feel the heart, because if somebody wants to build their business, whether we want to sell it or have the freedom that you're talking about, you're going to have all these other roles, right? You have to have people. So I'm curious, just from your point of view and your experience, what do you see as the toughest role consistently across the board for people to fill?
Yeah, salespeople. Because look, contractors aren't always great salespeople, but they're really good at what they do, right? Mm-hmm. And that subject matter expertise makes them really good with customers, because they can just talk about what they do all day long, and customers crave that competency, right? They crave talking to someone who knows what they're doing. You don't have to be some slick sales guy, but you have to be credible. And it's so hard to teach some 25-year-old just out of college or just out of university to be able to talk intelligently about the breadth of what you do, right? So, I mean, a home remodeler, I mean, there's just thousands of variables that go into building out a new kitchen. You can't possibly train some kid to do that. Here's the secret in my experience is you've got to sell less stuff. You've got to productize your service. And what I mean productize, I mean make it look like a thing. Services are things you buy by the hour, by the job, by the day, whereas productized, you're a pool maintenance guy, right? We're going to do pool maintenance and we're going to do, 12 months of the year hassle-free pool system, right? We're going to come adjust your chemicals. We'll make sure that if there's any, pump issues, we're going to preemptively manage those. It's a productized service. It looks like a thing. And young people can sell that. They can sell something that is tangible and product. It's infinitely more simpler, if you will, to sell a product. It's why every new young salesperson goes and sells cell phones, right? Exactly. You go to the mall, at the kiosk, there's like 16-year-olds selling cell phones. Cause you know what? It's easy. You can talk feature like iPhone, Android. I mean, it's easy. It's a feature. It's a set of features and you can sell around that. Selling complex solutions. Oh, you want a $300,000, new kitchen renovation. Like that's a complicated sale. Whereas if you productize and make it, you've got your three programs. I'm a lawn care company. I've got my, weekly cut and trim. I've got my weekly cut and trim plus a spring and fall cleanup. And I've got my bi-week, whatever. You've got your three productized services. All of a sudden you can send a kid to go sell that because it's a thing and not a service.
Love that. We talk about that a lot, Tom, like, niching down. You mentioned that earlier. And Logan, one of our marketing experts in one of our groups, was talking about getting rid of the custom feature. So if you can be a kitchen remodeler, and Lord knows you could go any millions of directions with that. But if you take custom out of it, you're like, here are some packages that work for most of our customers. You can make it a simple, repeatable service, as opposed to like everyone being this, breaking new tracks and starting from scratch. It's like, no, here's the process we do. You can simplify it so it's not reliant on the craftsman's brain or whatever.
And what do you guys get as the rebuttal or objection when, if you talk to a remodeler, kitchen guy, and said, hey, like if you niche down to have three packages, like bronze, silver, gold kitchens, what is the objection you hear from your guys on that?
They seem to think they're the only one that can build these creations. They're the only ones that can build a shelf for six coffee cups, and it's not going to be the same. And so part of it, it's just the struggle we have, the bigger struggle of getting these guys to think not like the carpenter, but like the business owner, and just
The artist takes over, is I would say.
The artist takes over. Yeah.
Like there's a guy who builds these gorgeous water features that I coached for several years. And we worked out some packages for him. And our sales process that we teach, before he even goes out there, the customer knows about what it's going to cost. It's a formality to go out there and just do the paperwork, right? And he got this, $10,000 budget from this customer, and he goes out there and one of two things would happen, John. He would sell the job for exactly what it was. He'd produce the job and then not make the profit he thought, because while they were on site, they over-designed it because the artist takes over. Oh, this rock, we should get another boulder like this. When the customer was totally happy, like 3 days ago, right? So he cut himself there. or he'd go out there with an $8,000 or $10,000 budget. And then he'd get so excited about the project and customize the thing to now they got to think about it. Now they got to get other bids because it went from a $10,000 project to 15. Now they got to think about it. So that's, you know, so what I told him is I said, I want you to go out there from now on. And I said, if they give you a $10,000 budget, you go out there and you design a functional $8,000 hole in the ground. Then listen, after you get the yes and you got the signed paperwork, then let the artist take over and go, hey, some other people have done this. And, you know, let me know if you want to talk about any of these other options. But that's after you got the job. So,
yeah,
I'd say the in the trades, the artist, Dan, probably takes over. Like you said, nobody else could build this, you know, shelf that can hold coffee cups the way I can, right? So it's,
or even materials, like you need marble, like cut from Sicily and shipped across through the Suez Canal. You know, it's like you're wondering why your cash flow sucks because you don't have the stone and you have to wait 6 months to lead. It's like, you know, just simplify things. We just create problems. It's human nature to make things more complicated than they need to be.
I think one of the common themes I'm hearing is that there is more pride in the job than pride in owning the company. And what I would challenge folks to do is inject as much or more pride in building a company than you do in your job. Like the contractors I know, they have a tremendous, and they can talk all day long about the way they solve the specific customer problem that, you know, they brought the marble in from Italy, you know, et cetera. But if you took the same sort of excitement, energy into building the value of your company, your brand. I got invited to a thing for entrepreneurs. It's called Birding the Giants. It's sort of a pretentious name, but it was a thing for entrepreneurs. There were 60 of us in the room. And this goes back 15 years ago now. And we were all in this kind of amphitheater style seating. Mm-hmm. We were hearing from amazing authors like Pat Lencioni, the guy who wrote Five Dysfunctions of a Team, if you know him, mm-hmm. Jack Stack, Stake in the Outcome guy, a bunch of great people. In walks this guy, never forget, his name is Steve Watkins. And he says, great. So there were 62 of us in the room, amphitheater style sitting. And he says, raise your hand if you're involved in the selling for your company, like selling your customers or whatever. And like every one of us, like the 9-year-old girl in like grade 3, like putting her hand up in the air saying, me, pick me. Like every one of us put our hands in the air. And he says, okay, put your hands down. And he says, you all have the right skills, but you're selling the wrong product. Hire salespeople to sell to customers. Use the same skills and marketing and sales skills that you have internally. Invest them in your company, in building the value of your business, in finding people to, you know, acquire your business, et cetera. You got the right skills, you're just selling the wrong product. And it, you know, the artist takes over. It's like you've got so many of the right skills. Just use the same skills, but consider your business your ultimate creation.
Is there a rule of thumb? See, I have a great memory. It's just really short. So I remember all these things through the years that I've picked up, right? It's like I'm flying through life and it's like lint is sticking to me as I'm going through life. And I have these little recollections. And for all I know, it could have been through your content through the years. Okay. So if you deserve credit for this, then
I'll steal it no matter what.
Here it is. But I heard somewhere along the line that if you're the owner, you want to set your business up so you're not doing about 20% more than 20% of the sales revenue. Was that from you?
No, that wasn't from me. I could
just say yes. No one will ever.
Yeah, yeah, sure, of course. And by the way, no, I trademark. No.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Like, what's the sweet spot that you don't you want to be responsible for as the owner for annual sales?
Well, the sweet spot is zero. Okay. And I don't mean to say that in a
right.
In a glib way, but the ideal to get your business to be as valuable as possible is to make it zero. I'll give you an example. A guy I had on the podcast recently, his name is Greg. God, what's his last name? I wrote it down. Alexander. So I do this thing called Built to Sell Radio where I interview people who've sold their company. Greg built up a business all the way up, big, you know, relatively big business, $30 million in annual revenue. and he went to sell it, but he was obsessed with this idea of building a business that wasn't dependent on him. So by the time he sold, 0% of his revenue was coming from him personally. And he was so obsessed with this idea that he sent his second in command, his general manager, to negotiate with the buyers of his business. Long story short, he sold his business for $162 million. That in and of itself is an unbelievable outcome.
What's that? That's like six times the top six line revenue?
Top line revenue.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Like an infinite multiple of EBITDA. I mean, it was an incredible growth story. What makes it though fascinating from the nature of what we're talking about today is that he never met the buyers. They wrote him $162 million check and he has never met the buyers. That's the level to which he went to try to get his business to operate without him. He didn't even show up at the negotiations to sell his own company for fear of being, you know, being accused of being too dependent, the company being too dependent on him personally. So, I mean, 20% is, you know, of your sales dependent on you is better than 80%. But if you can get it down to zero, that's the ultimate, you know.
I thought you were going to say that the reason he didn't go is he probably wouldn't have gotten as much for the company if he would have gone and negotiated on his own behalf. Because I've seen that a lot, right?
Yes. And that's why you need like a broker, an M&A professional by the way, that's not what I do for a living. So I'm not saying that in a self-serving way, but yeah, you want to have a foil or someone to negotiate with you. But eventually, even if you've got an M&A professional or business broker, the acquirer usually wants to meet you and they want to meet you to gauge rapport, make sure you're, you know, good person, et cetera. But they also want to say like, how dependent is this company on you personally? And they've got a bunch of ways they evaluate that. But in Greg's case, he was like, I'm not even going to meet with him. Send in my general manager who basically, you know, has authority to make this decision.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Love it.
So I feel the answer to this question, if I'm going to mind read, is going to be, you're going to start with, it depends, okay, which is totally cool. But I'm curious two questions. What is the most important factor when somebody wants to sell their business that will lead to a profitable sale? And then second, what's the average multiplier and how is that found?
Yeah. So two different questions for sure. Hub and spoke, I think for contractors is the most essential. So we've talked about it a bunch, but hub and spoke being how dependent is your company on you personally? That's one of the eight drivers of value we refer to. And it's the most important for contractors. Most of them have a hub and spoke business model where you've got customers, employees, suppliers, all coming to the hub for an answer. If you remember the old Nextel walkie-talkie technology, it was like the ultimate hub and spoke, right? Like you were constantly on your phone, dispatching jobs, looking at pricing, getting employees to do what you want. Yep. It's the disaster scenario for selling your company because it's too dependent on you personally. So that's number one. So if you want to move up the value of your company, I think that's where you want to go. Three different types of buyers are going to pay more or less of a higher multiple for your business. And so the lower end of buyers for most contracting businesses, and when I say lower end, I'm thinking top line revenue, maybe like $1 million or $2 million. Mm-hmm. Those are usually sold to other individuals who want a job. They see you doing $1 million in mowing lawns and they're like, yeah, I want a job, independence. I'm going to buy that business. They're usually trading at, you know, somewhere in the 2 to 3 times SDE range, seller's discretionary earnings, which is basically your profit, including your salary, any benefits you take, the truck and whatever you take as a benefit. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the kind of quote lower end.
Yeah.
Then you've got businesses that are in that sort of maybe $2 to $10 million of revenue that are usually trading at a multiple of EBITDA, multiple of earnings before interest, tax, depreciation. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like think about it as, you know, a pre-tax profit for most contractors for intensive purposes because they don't have a lot of, you know, debt or amortization, et cetera. And, you know, those are often bought right now by private equity groups. So private equity groups are running around rolling up virtually every industry. So I don't know this to be true, but I'm guessing there's a private equity roll-up of lawn care companies. There's probably a private equity roll-up of swimming pool maintenance companies. They're looking to do this all over the place. They use a lot of debt to buy your business, and they generally buy only a majority, but not all of the business. And they're trading it. You know, again, it's going to run the gamut based on how much recurring revenue you have, et cetera. But I think 4 to 7 or 8 is probably where times earnings is where you probably range. And then strategic acquirers are ones where they've just made a strategic decision that they want to own your business and it's worth more in their hands. So I talked to Tom Farinacci. Do you know Tom?
No, I don't.
Houston Greenleaf. Mm. He built a great little lawn care company in Houston. I shouldn't say little. It was, I think, $4 million in revenue, 46 employees when he sold it. Well, there's a strategic, large lawn care United States national company that said, Houston's the fourth largest and third fastest growing city in the United States. I want to own the biggest lawn care company. He got swallowed up by them. And when you get bought by a strategic, multiples can go up because it's worth more in their hands than it is in yours. Okay. So that's a very long-winded answer to your question that sounds maybe hopefully better than it depends.
So I have a one of our Facebook groups has guys in it that just you have to do a minimum of $2 million a year to be in this group. And I posed a question in the group the other day. I shared that I was going to be interviewing you. And I have two questions that I'd love to answered for these guys. One guy's Casey Fabling, good buddy of mine. He said, referring to you, his way of describing the ideal salesperson in the book was really helpful. Okay. Does he have a similar distilled way to describe the ideal sales manager? And so, first, maybe give us some highlights of the ideal salesperson, and then how would you answer his sales manager question?
Yeah, in the book Built to Sell, we talk about the different salespeople that are successful, and it turns out that you're looking for someone who's had expertise selling products, not necessarily custom solutions. The custom solutions person is going to be the artist, right? They're going to come, and every customer is different, and every solution needs to be totally customized, and every problem needs a complete, you know, and when they hear a customer problem, they use the sales techniques they use is essentially consultative selling. And basically they consult and they listen for customer problems, provide a solution. Well, by the very nature of that style of selling, you're going to create a custom solution for everybody. And it's the antithesis of what we talked about. It's the opposite of what we talked about today.
Yep.
So what you want is people who have sold products, things that they don't have the luxury of reinventing the solution for everybody. They've got to do the mental gymnastics associated with saying, this is the product I offer and here's how it could benefit you. And that's a challenge, but it's something that can be done if you've sold a product before and you've had to sort of make that case of the features and benefits of this product will benefit you. So I think it's salespeople who have sold products. Competitiveness is going to be really important for salespeople. There's an old Harvard Business Review study that shows like the attributes over like a 25-year period of the most successful salespeople. It was the combination of two factors that are very rarely found in the same individual. The two factors are, number one, competitiveness, which is kind of a stereotypical attribute of salespeople, right? The need to win and the need to like compete and rank and win. The second factor, though, was empathy. The ability to empathize with the other person you're selling to. And the reason those two are almost always rarely in the same person is competitive people usually kind of walk all over their customers, right? Yep. And empathetic people just listen and say, wow, that must be really challenging and give away so much of their service. It sounds like the ornament guy that you were describing earlier. Yep. So when you find someone where those two attributes actually balance out, they're highly competitive, but also highly empathetic, hire them, especially if they sold products, because it's those two attributes in the combination of the same person that is way, way outranks any of the other attributes that predict success in sales.
I love that.
Still haven't answered Casey's question though.
Yeah. Does he have a similar distilled way to describe the ideal sales manager?
Yeah. Look, yeah, I think the ultimate job of a sales manager is to make their salespeople successful. And it sounds a bit like a cop-out, but effectively, I think a lot of people, they compensate their sales manager based on the gross revenue they bring in. And the problem with doing that is oftentimes you'll have three salespeople and one is like 80% of your sales. And it's right. just amazing. And in a lot a funny way, you're not really solving the hub and spoke problem because now you're no longer dependent on you personally, but you're super dependent on that one salesperson, mm-hmm. right? So the yep. great sales manager, I think they invest the most in their weakest people and they make it their job to make sure it's like the old coach, sports coach, right? The best coach brings out, I can't remember the old expression, but it's basically brings out the most in their worst player. Or makes their worst player better. It's easy to, if you've got Kawhi Leonard on your basketball team or mm-hmm. Mike Trout on your baseball team, anybody can coach those guys. It's like, how can you take the struggling right. person and bring them up? So I think that's probably what I would say to Casey.
Love that. Love it. You know, it's funny and not, well, I was going to say not to toot my own horn, but I will. well, because I, in all reality here, Dan, I mean, how many times do I say you got to be your own biggest fan, right? So if I'm not yep. my own biggest fan of our sales training program, then why the hell am I doing it, right? But John, we teach a phone pre-qualification method that I won't totally go into here, but I would say the majority of what we teach in there is tactical empathy. Hmm. Like Dan is an absolute rock star sales guy. He's a coach in our programs and stuff like that. And we're telling people all the time, people buy for their reasons, not for yours. And so it's your job as the salesperson. Step one of our process is called the motive. What is your motive for wanting to do this project? And it's really peeling the onion back and all that other stuff. And yeah, it's kind of rooted in that consultative stuff, but it's really not, because our whole goal of this pre-qualification process on the phone before I schlep my ass out to your house and tap dance along with 18 other bids you're getting, right, is I just want to know, John, are you and I qualified to have a second date? But, right? The first date's on the phone. Second, does this conversation, which the ones that are crushing it, we have a metric that we call ESR, effective sales rate, that we encourage guys to track. So if I sold 50 grand this week divided by how much time I spent in the sales process, driving, typing crap up, this and that. So the higher the number, the better. So those that are crushing it with a high ESR, that are changing their lives, paying off tons of debt, all this other stuff, they're the ones that have really committed to learning this empathy piece. And I believe it's something that can be learned like any other skill. You know, it might not come naturally for a lot of people, but I think it's something. Dan, you're amazing at it. Does it come naturally for you? We just lost you.
You know, while we get Dan back, one of the things that you shared back earlier, Tom, was the guy who did all, like he said, like, what, give me your 30-minute honey-do list, right? You want me to do mm-hmm. the dishes? Sure, no problem. Like, yeah. That's tactical empathy, right? Like, yeah. I'm here to do a job, but I know you're busy and, you know, if women are the 90% of the, you know, like your husband doesn't do the stuff you ask him to do. So like, give me, like, you want me to change the furnace filter? You want me to do the, you know, like, that's great empathy. Yeah. Love it. Yeah.
Dan, how many jobs and millions of dollars have you sold over the few years where you've heard from the client, you're way more money, but we really feel like you understand us? I mean, like, that is such a common thing for.
Common. Yeah. I have gotten reviews from people that didn't hire me. Like, I loved everything about the process. I couldn't afford them, or we couldn't do the timeline, or whatever it was. And it's, that's everything. You know, yeah. It's like the service is just the service. It's everything around it. Mm-hmm.
So, Dan, you want to ask John the other question from the Facebook group?
Yeah. So, right. So from Nathan, what's the ideal net profit that's attractive to most businesses looking to buy?
Say that again. What's the most ideal profit for?
What is an ideal net profit that is attractive to most businesses looking to buy?
I think he's meaning, what's the ideal net profit that's attractive to most buyers?
Most buyers. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was wondering if you're trying to buy a company or sell it. So, the higher, the better, essentially. So there is no magic net profit. What I would What I would say is that net profit is one of eight drivers of your company's value. There are a few others that we've talked about today. We've already talked about hub and spoke, which is one. Recurring revenue is another. The third is growth potential. And so if you are driving your net profit up so high, it's at the expense of your growth of a as a company, that actually could detract from the value of your business. So, you know, I say glib, you know, the more profit, the better, clearly, but as long as you're continuing to grow, if you're shutting off the growth of your company because you're just focused so much on your net profit margin, I think you can really hurt yourself. The other thing I would say to Nathan is net profit is a subjective description. What I mean by that, I mean that when you go to sell your company, you're going to go through, or you should go through, what is called an adjustments period, where you are effectively adjusting your profit and loss statement to express it in the way a buyer would experience it. That means that you're going to pull out anything you run through your company right now, which isn't legitimately a business expense. So if you go to Vegas twice a year and you charge your company for that, that's great right now for tax planning for you, although illegal, I should reinforce. You also want to pull that out because a buyer's not going to go to Vegas when on your business dime. Equally, if you're paying yourself 30 grand a year, but to replace yourself with a general manager, it might cost you 90, you're going to actually have to put 90 in there to show how your company would run with someone else. I'm reminded of a guy I interviewed. His name is Ari Ackerman. He sold a company called Bunk One, great little company. And he got an offer from a private equity group. And the offer is a little lower than Ari wanted. And they were kind of humming and hawing. And the private equity group said, look, our shareholders are saying we can't spend, I think it was 7x EBITDA. We can't spend a dollar more than 7x EBITDA or profit. And Ari said, well, that's just not enough for my life's work. I'm not willing to sell it. And so they went through an adjustments process. And what Ari did was go through his entire profit and loss statement and tried to express it in the eyes of the buyers, in with the experience the buyer would have. So he pulled out a bunch of expenses that the buyer wouldn't incur, thereby increased his profitability so much that when they applied the same 7x multiple, it was a much bigger number. He was happy and he drove off into the sunset and was super happy about it. So Nathan's question is, what's the ideal profit margin? I think more. However, as long as it's not stifling your growth. And before you go put your business on the market, Nathan, I want you to go through, hire somebody, usually a broker, an M&A guy in your local market, to go through the adjustments process, because that's an important step in the process and can really change materially how much money you sell your company for.
Yeah, the second part of his question was, you know, some guys have a great gross profit, but that doesn't mean the net profit is there. Is there a relation to that as far as the...
Yeah, for sure. So gross profit, meaning the profit you have after you pay for the expenses of what you sell, and then below the line expenses being everything else that you incur. And what's really something to keep an eye on is your gross margin. For a lot of guys, when they go to sell their company, they start to realize how important top line sales are, and they start to compete on jobs. They start to price themselves below their competitors to win revenue. And one of the biggest reasons deals die, like acquisitions deals die in due diligence, is an erosion of gross margin. An acquirer will look at your numbers and they'll get your numbers as part of their due diligence. Before they send you a check, they're going to go through all of your last 3-5 years of financial statements. And if they see your gross margin starting to tail off, they're going to draw the conclusion that you've had to start to compete on price. And everybody knows competing on price is a road to nowhere. And so if they see that gross margin trailing away down over the last 3 years of your business, they're going to be like, yeah, sure, your top line's growing, but you're just buying that revenue. And so just keep an eye. Ideally, what you want is at the very least flat gross margin, ideally even increasing gross margin, because that implies you're differentiating yourself even more. But that's one of the hidden things that people don't think about a lot. And they sign a letter of intent, they're going to sell their business, they buy the new, you know, RV or the new cottage or cat, you know, whatever. But the deal goes south because their gross margin was something they hadn't really thought about. So It's an important element.
So would you, would a typical buyer, I won't even say typical, would you, John, let's just go with you. If you were looking at Dan's painting company, would you be more inclined to buy if you saw the climbing gross margin and even a lower net? If the meaning, because the net could be the result of maybe I just have too much overhead, right? I've got, you know, and there's some inefficiencies there, or maybe I'm reinvesting a lot of, you know, that gross margin back into the marketing of the business and things like that. I'm just curious, like, based on the way that you just described it and how somebody might look at the trends, my first thought was I would be more interested in going, hey, what are they, how are they building their brand? And, you know, those sorts of things. And that would be more reflective in the gross.
Yeah, for sure.
Gross profit, I mean.
Yeah. I think having a growing gross margin and improving gross margin and it not showing up in the bottom line would cause a lot of questions for a buyer. And it would be just how you would respond to those. So if you responded by saying, yeah, we've been out investing a ton of marketing. We've hired a new general manager who he's just being onboarded right now. And that's going to make the business even more, you know, operate without me, et cetera. Like all those answers are great. Yeah, I get why your profit's down slightly because you're making these investments in the company. Cool. If you're unable to answer that question succinctly, it would suggest like there's a lot of fat in that expense line that I'm going to have to cut out as the buyer. Now, that might cause me to think this could be a great opportunity because a buyer may see a lot of fat and ways to cut and may say, great, I'm going to, you know, buy this business and make those very easy operational decisions and increase the profitability very quickly. The buyer though is going to be wanting to pay for that. So he or she's going to want to pay a relatively low multiple for your company, make those, you know, changes that they see. They're not going to necessarily reveal to you the things they see, but they are going to benchmark it and say, geez, these guys look like they're spending too much on X or Y. And they will be the beneficiary of those changes. So I would rather the owner, the person who's put all the sweat and blood into the company, get the benefit of that increased value as opposed to letting some, you know, buyer get the lift from that.
Good stuff. John, what haven't we asked you that we should
talk about? Man, I'm exhausted. I need a drink, dude. This has been going on forever. All I got is black coffee here.
Yeah.
I'm exhausted. Well,
I was drinking a smoothie and that doesn't do much to quench the thirst. So it's my fiance, she feeds me these, I call them the, I don't want you to die smoothie. That's got all this healthy stuff in them, which I'm not bitching about because I'm still alive. So
you're still alive, so it must be working.
So what else? What else is, you know, you got, you know, tens of thousands of contractors that are listening to this, and I'm just, what's one thing that maybe we didn't touch on that you want to leave them with?
Yeah, let me leave you with one idea. I did a podcast a while ago and the guy's like, I get on and he hits record and he says, okay, Warlow, yeah, you're the douchebag who wrote Built to Sell. And I was like, what? and what his point was like, you know, like you're the one out there promoting this kind of built to flip mentality. You're some Silicon Valley startup guy who, you know, is, and I did not at the time, I was expecting like a softball kind of interview. And I did not do a great job rebutting his sort of criticism. But I've thought about it a lot. I wish I had a do-over and I'm reminded of a guy named Joey Redner. So Joey built a company called Cigar City Brewing out of Tampa, Florida. Long story, but he realized there wasn't a lot of craft beer being bought in Tampa, yet craft beer was exploding all over the US. And he built a great little craft brewery, borrowed, I think it was $800,000 from his dad, and built this brewery. And it was a huge hit. Tampa was thirsty for craft beer. And the thing went off and all the, you know, great success. So much so that he ran out of brewing capacity and had to basically figure out like how he was going to meet the demand. So he goes and borrows a chunk more money, gets another loan from a bank, this time a couple $1 million, if memory serves, to build out his brewing capacity, right? So now he's in hock to his dad, profitable company, growing company, success story, but now he's debt to his dad. He's now got debt to the bank. Guess what? Brewer continues to be a huge success. Now he's a super regional player. People, Alabama, Louisiana, Florida, they're all buying his beer. So much so he runs out of brewing capacity a third time. And it's at that point he throws up his hands. And he says, I'm out. And I asked him about it on the podcast. I was like, why were you out? He said, I felt like the gambler at the Vegas blackjack table. And I had won five hands in a row. And the dealer was looking at me and asking me to go all in for a sixth time. And I just said, I can't do it. And he sold the company. He sold the company to a private equity backed Oscar Blues, craft brewery. The company went on to be a tremendous success. Joey obviously paid off all his debt, put a chunk of money in his jeans, bought a beautiful house in Florida. And he's not a douchebag for making that decision.
Yeah.
He built a company, a successful business, and decided that he wanted to go do something else with his life. Like, running a company is not a life sentence. Yeah. You're not a douchebag for wanting to sell it. Many of us put our best days into our companies in the first 5 or 10 years, right? When we're excited, there's creativity, there's newness, and there's nothing, you shouldn't be ashamed of wanting to go do something else. And that's what Joey did. And I think it worked out well for him, the brand, Tampa beer lovers everywhere, et cetera. So
I love that because it's, we should build a company that serves us.
That's right.
We're not the slave to. And, and I think there's a point in time when you wake up one day and you just go, I'm done. And that doesn't mean you failed, and
not at all.
Dan and I, we deal with contractors every day of the week. And it's like, if I'd have all the nickels in the world, if I had a nickel for every guy that's been in the trades for X amount of years, and at the end of his career, doesn't have shit to show for it. Right. Yeah. Because they didn't implement the things that we've been talking about here. Even if I want to remain a one or two person business, it doesn't mean that I have to be a slave to the thing. It means I need to set it up on my terms, be able to run and serve me. And it's just sad. And I think that's why we do what we do here is my dad, he died several years ago, but my dad was a tile guy and he had a couple other, he has seal coating business and stuff. And my recollection of my dad, and honestly, most contractors I knew growing up were dirty. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but they were dirty. They were tired and didn't have a lot of money. Hmm. Like that was literally the majority of contractors that I met. And I think that's a thing combined with the fact that our society has been telling us for the past 4 decades, go to college. And if you don't, you're a loser, right? It's hurt the trades. Certainly that message has, but I think when kids are growing up and the contractors they know are they're struggling, right? And they're never home or they're working too much. They don't have a lot of money. They don't vacation like their buddy's doctor dad does or whatever it is.
Yeah.
They go, why the hell would I want to be a contractor? But on the flip side, when you do this right in this industry, it's an amazing life.
I talked to the swimming pool guy that you do the show with. I mean, he's pretty happy with the decision he made.
Yeah. I mean, anyway, I don't want to get on that soapbox, but listen, man, I have one last question for you. Actually two, one of them is just where can people find you and your stuff? The other question, my buddy Travis, who produces my podcast here, has been doing it for years, almost, I think 400 episodes now or whatever we got. He created a really cool app called Poddex. And it's just for questions and things like that. I haven't been using, I use it at the end here and I kind of randomly flip through and I pick a question. So I don't know what the question's going to be. All right. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to ask you a question. You're probably going to have to bury your soul now or something, but anyway. All right, here we go. This one's easy. All right. What actor or actress would play you in a documentary?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you an embarrassing story. So I'm in Nashville. I can't remember where the hell I was. I was at a conference, and I'm on an elevator, and these two girls get on the elevator and they start to giggle, and it's kind of weird. I'm like, okay, why are these girls giggling? And so we're going down on the elevator. So we get to the bottom, and the one girl says, "Are you Doogie Howser?" And I'm like, "No, I'm not Doogie Howser."
Oh my God, I love
so
it.
So I have once in my life been, I don't know, been mistaken for that guy. And I'm like, "No, that's not me." So anyways, I don't know who would play me on TV, but I know who I don't want to play.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I get mistaken all the time for Denzel Washington. Like, it's just it's crazy. It's like, "Are you Denzel Washington?"
Spitting image. Yeah.
How about you, Dan? Who would play you?
It'd have to be like Lawrence Fishburne for all the swearing.
I love how you and I both pick black guys. I don't know what's up with that. But anyway. So, John, somebody's listening to this. They want to learn more about your stuff, what you do, how you can help, books, anything else you got going on. Where do they go?
I think the best place to do is go to builttosell.com. And in the top right corner, there's a little button that says free gifts. And we put together like a built to sell starter kit. It's free, obviously. And it's like, there's 8 videos that talk about the 8 drivers. There's a little checklist on creating recurring revenue that folks might like. There's the art of selling your business. There's a like a workbook we provide. So it's all there. It's just builttosell.com.
Awesome. Now you're just showing off with all that value, man. Look at you. So, well, awesome. I super appreciate you hanging out with us here
this
today.
This was fun.
And if there's ever anything we could do to help you, please tap us on the shoulder. Let us know. And I'm giving a shout out to our fighters that listen to this right now. I'm so proud of this community and how involved and engaged you guys are as listeners. Super appreciate it. And I know you listen to podcasts and watch videos and stuff. So also, guys, head over to, is it Built to Sell Radio? Is that your podcast?
Yeah, builttosell.com. And then there's a button that says radio. Yeah.
Yeah, because I know you got a great show going over there. So guys, head over there and give that a listen as well. So, but anyway, John, super appreciate your time here today. And with that, Travis, rock us out, bring the guitars in, and we will talk to you all next time on the Contractor Fight. Zoom recording. All right. Dan and I are now going to have a little chat on our biggest takeaways from John's interview. 3, 2. So Dan, John just jumped off the call and I wanted to include this little segment because we just started talking about our biggest takeaways. And I'm curious what yours was that you just started sharing with me.
Mine was that line that we're selling to the wrong people, that as business owners, instead we're selling to individual homeowners or whatever we're doing. And we should be selling our vision for our business and our culture to our people so that they can go out in multiples of us and spread the word.
Yeah. I have to tell you that was probably mine too. That's the thing I wrote down on my notes was that just kind of stuck with me there. There's a lot that goes into selling a business. A lot of things need to go right. But like you said, throughout the interview a couple of times, like even if you don't want to sell this thing, how cool would it be where it operates without you?
Yeah. Right? Like super cool.
You could take off for a couple months. You could take off for a year and you'd come back and the business would be stronger. Like I'd love to see more contractors build their business to the point where it's basically their fucking side hustle that just does a million or two a year without them. You know, how cool would that be? You know?
Or to give yourself other opportunities. Like my opportunity working with you is like, if I was a slave to my paint business, I couldn't do it, but it's like, it fills a different bucket of my life and, you know, rounds me out as a person. So it's, I kept going back to that comment by him and I was like struggling to stay in the conversation because I was like going down my rabbit holes in my head. Like, how can I implement this? I'm like, shit.
I could tell there was something going on. I could tell there was something going on in there in your brain. So, I think, and then the story that he shared at the end about the guy who set his business up to where he was never involved, wasn't even at the sale of the business and things like that. Guys, that can be done. It can be done. But I think, and we touched on this, you got to get out of that artist mentality, you know, and because it's truly holding back the growth of your business. Whether you want to sell it or not, it's holding back the growth of your business. You're never going to grow and have the freedom that you want as long as everything's fucking custom, And yeah. I'm not saying don't ever do custom work. Do custom work and charge out the ass for it. But every one of us should have a product that's here's different packages, different levels. You know, this is, hey, we're going to paint the walls only in the room. That's a fucking package, right? Yep. We don't have to customize it. There's nothing fancy about that. And, you know, it's easier said than done. You just got to commit to it. So,
well, since you know, that whole analogy of the teenagers selling smartphones at the kiosk in the mall, right. You know, like as business owners, we all want the Apple store to be who we are, like the coolest place in the world to come. It's just like, you know what? Like find something that you can just sell hand over fist and you can find people. You're not struggling to find workers or salespeople and just kill it.
Yep. Now, I guess I'll leave everybody with this. I would encourage you guys to try to figure out a way to get you in the home a few more times a year with something recurring. Shit, even if you break even on the recurring revenue site visit inspections or whatever the fuck you do, you know, and you got, and listen, Dan, you know, we talk enough about here in the fight about making a profit and making what you're worth. And so guys, don't misunderstand what I'm saying here for not making money, but if your cost here it is, Dan, if your cost per lead is $150, say it's $100 to get the phone ring and your cost per sale is $200 or $300, then why the hell wouldn't I spend the time or send somebody out to somebody who's already fucking given me money and has trust?
Yep.
My chances are higher that maybe not that day, but they're going to purchase with us again. Okay. And so I'm going to end up spending less in marketing, less to acquire a customer and all that other math that we won't get into now. So,
but yep.
Anyway,
like
man,
I always say.
It's good hanging with you here today. Fighters, head over to builttosell.com and check out what John's got going on. He's a good dude and really love his stuff. And I encourage you to check it out so that you can set your business up for massive success. And with that, Dan, I guess we're out of here. For real.
Sounds good, Tom.
For good.
Good hanging out.
All right, buddy. Talk to you later.
Yeah.